Back in the summer of 2000, one of my best friends and I were driving through the Smoky Mountains on our way to North Carolina. It was about 11 o'clock at night, pitch black. And for those of you who have never driven through the Smoky Mountains at night, let me assure you, they are very dark. Not suburban neighborhood with a few streetlights out dark, but more like this could absolutely be the opening scene of a horror movie dark. Now, this was also before smartphones, before Google Maps, before Waze, before a tiny computer in your pocket could tell you exactly where you were going, and how long it would take to get there. And importantly, where the next gas station is. We had a paper map and a flip phone with service that could best be described as optimistic. We also had a mix CD, and if memory serves, that mix CD contained some combination of Blink 182's All the Small Things, Backstreet Boys' Shape of My Heart, Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again, Eminem's The Real Slim Shady, and Celine Dion's That's the Way It Is. Which means that instead of carefully monitoring our fuel situation, we were doing what two college girls in the year 2000 were meant to do. Singing at the top of our lungs and performing a one-car concert tour through Appalachia. At some point, we passed a sign indicating how far it was to the next gas station. A useful piece of information. A piece of information that might have become intelligence if we'd realized how important it was about to become. Instead, we kept singing. Fast forward several miles. The music is still playing. The mountains are still dark. The fuel gauge is now getting uncomfortably close to empty. And suddenly, we're asking a very different question. Instead of asking whether the real Slim Shady would please stand up, we were asking, do either of us remember how far back that gas station sign was? And that's when uncertainty started getting really uncomfortable. Because now our question had become very, very specific. Do we have enough gas to avoid becoming an episode of Unsolved Mysteries? Now, eventually we did find gas. No dramatic rescue was required. We avoided ending up on a true crime podcast, and thankfully no serial killers emerged from the woods. But looking back, I've always found it interesting how quickly we went from confidently following a plan to desperately searching for information. A few minutes earlier, we were singing along to our mix CD without a care in the world. Now we were scanning road signs, there were uncomfortably few, checking the map, watching the fuel gauge, and trying to piece together enough information to decide what to do next. And that's really where intelligence begins, not with information or collection or even with analysis. It begins with a question. Welcome to The Unknown Knowns, where intuition meets tradecraft. I'm Dr. Angela Lewis, and this is a space for people who think for a living. Intelligence professionals, leaders, and decision makers navigating complexity, uncertainty, and imperfect information in a fast-paced world. Each week, we explore how intuition, bias, and judgment shape the way we make sense of complexity and how to get better at it. This week, we are tackling the second episode in a three-part series on intelligence. In the first episode, we explored what intelligence is and why it exists, why it is so difficult to define, and why intelligence is fundamentally about supporting decision-making under conditions of uncertainty. In this episode, we will unpack the intelligence cycle, the dominant framework used to describe how intelligence functions, and why so many intelligence professionals have such a strange love-hate relationship with the model. And as a preview, in our third episode, we're going to talk about how intelligence actually behaves beyond the cycle. So today, we're going to look at the framework that has shaped generations of intelligence professionals, what it is, why it became so influential, and why it remains one of the most widely taught concepts in intelligence. So let's start with a simple question. Where did the intelligence cycle come from? One of the interesting things about the intelligence cycle is that intelligence existed long before anyone drew a circle with boxes in it. Ancient kingdoms had spies. Military commanders gathered information. Governments used diplomats, merchants, travelers, and scouts to understand the world around them. Even private organizations did. Intelligence has existed for thousands of years. But the intelligence cycle has not. The intelligence cycle largely emerged in the years following World War II, as intelligence organizations became larger, more specialized, and more bureaucratic. As those organizations grew, they needed a way to explain how intelligence was produced. They needed a common language and a framework or model that could help to answer a deceptively simple question: who does what for whom? The intelligence cycle became that model. At its core, the cycle describes how organizations attempt to transform questions into answers. Interestingly, intelligence didn't always operate through a formalized cycle. As Cibeline CEO Justin Crump points out in his book, Corporate Security Intelligence and Strategic Decision-Making, historical intelligence organizations often functioned effectively without any explicit model at all. The Duke of Wellington, for example, maintained a sophisticated intelligence apparatus during the Napoleonic Wars, long before anyone drew a circle with arrows connecting collection, analysis, and dissemination. The difference was scale. As technology advanced, communications accelerated, and information became more abundant, organizations needed more structure. Intelligence was no longer a handful of disparate people sharing observations. It was becoming an increasingly complex organizational activity, and complexity creates a need for frameworks and process to provide clarity. That said, not everyone agrees on what exactly the intelligence cycle is. Well-known intelligence professional Mark Lowenthal notes that there are multiple versions of the cycle, with different organizations emphasizing different stages, combining certain activities, or labeling them differently. But despite those variations, the underlying idea remains remarkably consistent. Intelligence begins with a question, information is gathered, meaning is created, insight is communicated, and the process begins again. One of the biggest misconceptions about intelligence is that it begins with information. It doesn't. In reality, it begins with a question. In intelligence, the first stage is usually called planning and direction. That's where intelligence requirements begin. Requirements are simply the questions intelligence is expected to help answer. What threats should we be watching? What opportunities are emerging? What risks matter most? What decisions are coming that will require additional understanding? Of course, in practice, requirements are rarely that simple. Imagine your CFO asks a question, something like, how exposed are we to geopolitical instability in Southeast Asia? Seems straightforward enough. But then somebody has to figure out what that question actually means. Why do they care? Is there a specific decision they're trying to make? What countries are we talking about? What types of instability? Political unrest? Regulatory changes? Conflict? Economic disruption? What time horizon matters? Next month? Next year? The next decade? And that leads to still more questions. Who should gather the information? Where should they look? How much confidence do we need in the sources? How should the answer be delivered? A briefing, a written report, a graphic, a dashboard? And how do we know whether it was actually useful? What started as a single question has suddenly become a surprisingly complicated organizational activity. And that's exactly why planning and direction matters. In many ways, planning and direction and the resulting requirements is the most important stage of the cycle because it determines everything that follows. And to be honest, intelligence professionals often joke that half of the job is answering questions and the other half is figuring out what question the decision maker is actually asking. If you're asking or trying to answer the wrong question, it doesn't matter how good your collection is. You can answer the wrong question perfectly and still fall short. And it's important to note that every intelligence requirement is also a resource allocation decision, because attention, time, and resources are finite. If you choose to focus on one issue, you're choosing not to focus on another. And in a fast-paced environment with limited resources and finite bandwidth, priorities really matter. In his book, Justin makes a related observation that I think most leaders intuitively understand. Every intelligence function operates within constraints. Because there is never unlimited time, money, people, or attention, every requirement becomes a trade-off. Every question we choose to pursue means another question receives less attention. Prioritization, therefore, isn't a bureaucratic exercise, it's a strategic one. Once planning and direction has occurred and intelligence requirements are established, the next step is collection. It's the stage most people think about when they hear the word intelligence: spies, satellites, secret sources, hidden microphones. The reality is usually far less glamorous. Collection can involve human sources, certainly, but depending on the domain, it can also involve news reporting, social media, financial records, interviews, internal company data, government reporting, commercial databases, vendor content, technical sensors, imagery, and countless other sources of information. In fact, much of modern intelligence collection comes from publicly available information. Collection is simply the process of determining the right sources and gathering information relevant to the question. But collection alone isn't intelligence. One of the interesting observations made by intelligence scholars is that collection is rarely the only challenge. Organizations often assume that if they can just gather enough information, the problem, whatever it is, will solve itself. But intelligence history is filled with examples where the information existed, But organizations still struggled to recognize its significance, connect it to other information, or communicate it effectively to decision makers. In other words, collection is necessary, but information alone is rarely sufficient. Processing and exploitation comes next. This is probably the least glamorous stage of the intelligence cycle. And yet, it's becoming more and more important as the data and information that we collect is becoming more complex and its provenance is harder to determine. Processing and exploitation involve transforming raw information into something usable. Think about how much information exists in the world today. Millions of articles and reports and endless streams of data. Collection gathers the information, but processing helps make it usable. Information may need to be translated, organized, categorized, structured, verified, cleaned, indexed, or otherwise prepared for analysis. In many ways, processing and exploitation is the stage that separates information availability from information usability. Ultimately, information that later can't be replicated, searched, documented, translated, or organized might as well not exist. If collection gathers information, analysis is where intelligence really starts to be created. This is where intelligence professionals begin asking questions like, what does this mean? Why is it happening? And most importantly, what are the implications? What do decision makers need to know and understand? As we discussed in the last episode, information and intelligence are not the same thing. A fact, report, a piece of data, those are not intelligence. Rather, intelligence emerges when information is interpreted in a way that supports decision-making. And unlike popular portrayals, intelligence analysis is rarely about certainty. In fact, Sherman Kent, often called the father of modern intelligence analysis, argued that intelligence is fundamentally about helping decision-makers understand situations that are uncertain, incomplete, and constantly evolving, which is why most intelligence assessments are estimative. Analysts are dealing with incomplete information, ambiguous signals, conflicting evidence, and uncertain futures. The goal isn't perfect prediction. The goal is reducing uncertainty enough to support better decisions. More often than not, analysis is about evaluating competing explanations, identifying risks, assessing probabilities, and helping leaders navigate that ambiguity. And finally, we move on to dissemination, getting intelligence to the right people. The best intelligence assessment ever written has exactly the same value as no intelligence assessment at all if nobody reads it or understands it, or if the right person doesn't receive it in enough time to act on it. This is the dissemination stage. Dissemination is the process of delivering intelligence to decision makers. And here's where many intelligence professionals learn a hard lesson. Intelligence isn't produced for analysts. It's produced for consumers. A decision maker who wants a 5-minute briefing may not read a 20-page report. A board member may need different information than a security manager. A CEO may need a strategic overview, while an operations team needs tactical detail. Effective dissemination isn't just about delivering intelligence. It's about delivering intelligence in a form the consumer can actually use. That might take the form of a written report, a briefing, a dashboard, a graphic, a conversation, an email, a presentation, or a combination of those things. And this is where intelligence professionals learn an important lesson. The best intelligence in the world is useless if it's delivered in the wrong format, at the wrong time, to the wrong audience. Intelligence isn't just about producing insight, it's about communicating insight to the right audience at the right time. And although it's usually combined with dissemination, feedback doesn't receive enough attention. Feedback helps intelligence organizations understand whether their products were useful. Did the intelligence answer the question? Did it support the decision? Did it arrive in time? What follow-up questions emerged? What needs to happen next from an intel perspective? The most useful feedback isn't necessarily whether the assessment was right, although getting it right is absolutely one important metric, but the key is whether it was useful. And those two are not always the same thing. An assessment can contain accurate information and still fail to help a decision maker. Likewise, an assessment can highlight uncertainty, frame risks, and improve understanding even when the future unfolds differently than expected. Feedback helps intelligence organizations learn, and it helps shape future requirements, which brings us back to the beginning of the cycle. Even leaders who never work in intelligence can recognize the logic of the cycle, because most organizations have some version of it. A question emerges, information is gathered, meaning is created, a decision is made, the outcome is evaluated. In that sense, the intelligence cycle isn't just an intelligence framework, it's a structured way of thinking about organizational learning. Yet, as Justin described it, The intelligence cycle is something of a paradox. Almost everyone acknowledges that it's imperfect. Scholars criticize it and practitioners complain about it. Pages upon pages have been written arguing that it oversimplifies how intelligence actually works. Even scholars like Mark Lowenthal have acknowledged the cycle's limitations. And yet, nearly every intelligence organization teaches some version of it. Why? Because it works remarkably well as a teaching tool. And perhaps it was never intended to be a perfect representation of reality. It's a framework for understanding, a map, if you will. And like any map, its value isn't that it captures every single detail. Its value is that it helps us navigate. But as useful as a basic analog map is, it doesn't show the terrain, the traffic, the road hazards, or suggest alternative routes. And the closer we examine how intelligence actually functions inside organizations, the harder it becomes to see intelligence as a neat sequence of steps. Questions emerge during analysis. Collection changes priorities. Feedback may happen continuously or not at all. New stakeholders appear, decisions change the environment, and the process starts adapting in ways the traditional cycle doesn't fully capture. In our next episode, we're going to explore those limitations. We'll look at why many intelligence scholars and practitioners have argued that intelligence does not behave like a linear cycle, and why I argue that it behaves more like a dynamic, adaptive system. And we'll explore what that means for intelligence professionals, leaders, and organizations operating in an increasingly complex world. Thanks for listening to The Unknown Knowns. If this episode made you think or rethink, share it with a colleague or friend who's ready to level up their tradecraft. Subscribe for more short, sharp conversations about the art and science of professional judgment. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and keep turning intelligence into impact.